Your opinion, who would manage this pool if this came in? I mean, is it, would it be done by professionals? Would it be done by the members themselves? Or how do you read this?
Mr. Chairman, as outlined in here, they would have a board of trustees. The makeup of the trustees are spelled out, and they would contract with the TPA. There are a number, that's a third party administrator, I'm sorry. There are a number of duties, though, that we as a division would be assuming that are not part of our normal regulatory duties. They're more administrative rather than regulatory.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me go ahead and ask my question because we're kind of leading into it. I'm looking at something here. Looks like there's probably about 300 of these businesses. And it says they only need 5 to form a pool. And you've got a physical note in here. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't there be a lot of difference in your costs if you formed one pool of 300 members, and then if we formed 60 pools with 5 members each?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the premium tax would be the same, the lost revenue to the state, whether they were.
Well, that's what your business reflects.
There is a loss. We also made an assumption that has been echoed by some of the members of the builders group, that other groups would follow. We did not assume that this would be the one and only group. We assumed that others would follow. And it's an estimate based on the premium of those groups.
So it was a Sanders.
There's nothing in your physical note then that reflects oversight over these groups.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are 3 numbers. One is loss of premium tax revenue. There's also a fiscal note indicating the increased administrative duties that the division would have to assume. There is also one other issue here that has not been addressed, and that is the fact that insurers pay fees to us to perform the duties we do in a regulatory basis. The amount that is proposed to be paid to the division here is $500. Insurers pay $2,500, so there is a difference in revenue there.
But the more they have, the more you get, so it would wash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Representative Ryan.
One quick one. We all hope that enterprises like this will be successful and work well, but we have to look at a worst-case scenario. And as I mentioned earlier, in the world market with Lloyd, it's been a very catastrophic loss thing. So where does the state of Alaska's liability come in if this thing, say we put it into practice, and it doesn't work, the bottom falls out, the wheels fall off, and there are people out there who, has there been any court experience on this? If they deem that the state was negligent by not taking the proper precautions, and the state has to compensate these people?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that issue is open. I don't know what would happen. It is not an insurer. It does not have the safeguards to keep the state from being liable. I think it would be a finding of fact whether the state would have to assume the liability. It does say that these monies are payable to the state, and the state will pay it out in claims. What if there's not enough money? That's not addressed. I don't know if the state would be liable or not. I would assume that there's always that real possibility if they've got an injured person out there and they don't have any money and no one's paying their medical bills and feeding their family. They're going to go on state programs to pay those medical bills.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burke. We have 4 more people are signed up to testify. I'd like to get their testimony in, so I would, and I'd like Mr. Wilson to come forward now. I would ask, because of the lateness of the hour, we try to keep the testimony down to no more than about 5 minutes, if you could, or shorter, if possible. And please identify yourself and your affiliation, sir.
My name is Alan Wilson. I am a member of the Alaska State Home Builders. I am a builder here in Juneau, and I will be as brief as possible. I am going to testify as how this bill will affect me as a small builder. I employ 4 to 5 people seasonally. Under the current system of workers' comp, I pay the same rate, which is $17 per hundred of payroll. I pay that for a journeyman carpenter, and I also pay that for a high school kid that's on summer break. This serves as a disincentive for hiring inexperienced or young people into this trade. If we convert to a self-insuring system, my work comp rates would be reduced through rebates. The potential savings would allow me to hire additional employees as well as that high school person that needs training to become employable in this industry. Additionally, and perhaps most importantly, the self-insured system emphasizes safety on the job because a reduction in work-related accidents results in rebates to the group's members. Currently, I can be the most safety-conscious builder on the block, and it has absolutely no bearing on my workers' comp rate. We all pay the same. Under the self-insured system, the more safety-conscious we are, the more we save, and we all know there's no better motivator than money. I will add that the mod rate, the Marianne's experience modification rate that Marianne spoke about, I called my broker recently and got a blank answer from him. He's going to follow up on that. I'm sure that all the builders in this room after this meeting will be calling their brokers to find out about this as well. It's not being promoted to us, the consumer. The size of the Alaska State Home Builders Association has been called into question by some. The argument is that 850 members aren't enough to make self-insurance financially feasible. A review of other states that have allowed self-insuring clearly shows that this is not the case. New Mexico successfully initiated its program with only 800 association members. Within 4 years, the number of participants in New Mexico's program reached 363, and today there are over 1,500 participants. In addition, over 90% of its members choose to renew year after year. As I said, money is a strong motivator. Premium income within the last 5 years has grown from $3.7 million to $17.6 million in the New Mexico program. North Carolina has grown from 488 participants in 1985 to 7,014 in 1994, and they are now the largest workers' comp insurer in the state. The most important measure of this bill is the focus it brings to accident prevention and the injured worker. Let's face it, the building industry, saving money on workers' comp rates and maintaining the highest quality of safety on job sites is a win-win situation. The self-insured workers' comp bill before you is the key to a safer job site across the state of Alaska. I would urge all of you to approve this bill, and I believe it represents model legislation for the entire country. And I certainly thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Is there any question for Mr. Wilson? Mr. Wilson, you said, so for all your payroll, your rate is $17 per hundred of all payroll. Is that a gross?
Yes, sir.
Gross payroll?
Yes, sir.
Prior to deductions or anything else?
Yes.
Is that just a, you know, okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to hear from Linda Hall, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Linda Hall. I'm a commercial insurance broker here today representing the Alaska Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. It's a trade association of independent agents across the state who work with employers as our clients and who represent multiple insurance companies. I, too, will try to say this in about 3 minutes, so if I talk too fast, I do that normally, and I will really talk fast. We oppose this bill in two general areas. One is a general concern with the effect on the insurance marketplace, and the other are some of the actual provisions. The workers' compensation market in Alaska right now is the strongest most of us have ever seen it. There are increasing numbers of new companies writing business here. It has been a profitable market. Within the last month, a new company came into the state specifically targeting those premiums that we're talking about today, the $1,000 to $20,000 premium range. There has been a point where that was a difficult type of risk to place, but there are markets interested in Alaska, interested in Alaska businesses. Work comp rates has been referred to have increasingly gone down since the work comp reforms in 1988. Overall, there's been a 40.1% decrease in workers' compensation rates. Director Burke referred this year to a 10.3 rate decrease. The carpentry rate that's been referred to here today for one and two family dwellings has gone in 1997 from $16.30 to $11.71, so 28% decrease. This is not a market that is not functioning. We really feel that other employers who have adequate safety protections, who have a good loss record, can obtain additional credits. I'm seeing credits in the marketplace right now anywhere from 10 to 40%. It is a market that has benefited all Alaskan employers, and we're very concerned if we start taking specific industry groups, pulling them out of that overall market, the effect on the remaining Alaska work comp marketplace will be very detrimental. Workers' compensation premium in Alaska overall is a very small portion of the premium nationally. If we have insurance companies looking for places to invest their assets, invest their resources, they are going to want a sufficient amount of premium to make that worth their while. So if we allow specific industry groups to pull the premium out, soon we don't have a premium base that attracts new companies. We don't have the type of marketplace that we're seeing right now. For those reasons, we are very concerned about the overall effect and the effect that would have on employers who don't qualify for self-insurance groups. The other area I'd like to quickly address are some of the provisions in House Bill 116. This sets up a new chapter for self-insurance groups. This chapter specifically states in its scope that the groups would not be subject to the provision of the insurance laws except as specified in the chapter. This means, as has been mentioned before, they're not paying premium tax, they're not contributing to guarantee funds. It sets them up with an unfair financial advantage. It sets them up with an unfair advantage against insurers who have to pay those costs, other employers who aren't eligible for those groups. It also takes away protections that are currently in insurance statutes. Protections, unfair discrimination. We've heard testimony today about asking members to leave a group if they didn't follow safety procedures. There would be no anti-discrimination statutes. The Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act of the insurance chapters would not apply to these groups. I'm not going to talk about the solvency issues. I think they have been discussed at length. I would like one last comment to talk about the rates mandated in this bill are manual rates. Those are mandated to be charged for 5 years. If we're talking charging manual rates, we're talking the same rates insurers are charging right now. We are talking about additional administrative expenses for reinsurance, excess insurance, audits, administration, third-party administrators. There's a whole list of expenses outlined in this bill. I'm not sure that I understand how we save money when we're mandating charging manual rates for 5 years. We're talking all kinds of insurance requirements to the point I'm not sure where we really have any room left to save rates. Again, I would emphasize there are already in statute provisions for reciprocal insurers, provisions for purchasing groups that would allow various associations to put together mechanisms to solve some of the other types of problems that they may see in their industry. Again, with the time constraints, I do thank you for your time. At some later date, if you continue this hearing, I will also be available to testify or to answer questions.
Saul, just for the record, how many insurance companies are underwriting workers' comp insurance in the state right now?
I would have to defer to the Division of Insurance. I don't know how many. I just know it's substantially more than 5 years ago.
Right, and are there questions of Ms. Paul?
If I could just
Representative Cotter.
We talked a little bit about the offshore market, and could you explain about it? I've heard horror stories of in the garage or in companies that don't exist. Can you spell a little bit of information on
the
that?
Offshore markets?
Yeah.
Typically are set up to avoid regulation. It's a different type of regulation, and it may be foreign insurers, it may be what are called captives. Frequently the offshore markets are captives. A large conglomerate may form its own insurance company called a captive to write its own insurance and spread out into other types of insurance, and Bermuda is, for some reason, very attractive to captive insurers, and they don't meet the types of requirements that U.S. regulators have.
Have they been a problem in Alaska that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. They do crop up occasionally, but I think there have been very diligent efforts to see that they don't enter our marketplace.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Mr. Wilson better call you up and get a good referral to an agent. You've got $11 rates.
She is for this bill, right?
No, no. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you.
Mr. Grassi, why don't you come forward? Well, it's a pleasure to see your smiling face here.
No, thank you.
For the record.
For the record, I'm Chairman Rokeberg, committee. I'm Paul Grassi. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation for the state of Alaska. I was prepared to talk about a lot of the things, and I think most of the things were covered by Director Burke and others, and so I don't really want to repeat those things. I would like to say that last year the home builders came to us with a bill, and this year's effort is a lot better effort. But I would agree with Mary Ann, there are still some concerns, and the concerns primarily are solvency. And from the Department of Labor's view, we're concerned that injured workers are not going to be paid. And under this system, there are still some deficiencies. Mary Ann has pointed most of them out. They seem to be undercapitalized. I would agree with Mary Ann that I don't see how we don't see how you can judge the financial viability of a group without being able to judge the financial viability of the individual members. And that seems to me that would be the first thing that you would address. And I would say that we require, we being the Division of Insurance, the Department of Labor, for self-insurers to file their audited financial statements when they're coming into to make an application, originally three past years, and then annually we require them to file an updated audited financial statement. We know what their financial conditions are yearly. And
excuse me, Mr. Grassi, who is that now?
Under Title 23, we approve certificates of self-insurance for individual employers.
For what type of insurance?
This is just for an individual employer so that they can pay workers' compensation.
Oh, an individual.
Basically. Yeah, this is just an individual. This is not a pooling of risk in any way. It's just for the employer directly to pay their liabilities under the Workers' Compensation Act, and we have that provision in the Workers' Compensation Act. But we do require these individuals to be highly capitalized. And for example, getting into the minimum asset, $1 million for this group, we do require $5 million in assets for an individual employer. And we can't see why this group should be held these groups should be held to a lesser standard. You know, maybe they could be, but it would seem to me that you would at least want to require, if $1 million is going to be required as assets, they should be liquid. So because of course you've, I don't want to get into repeating a lot of the same testimony, but the premium that you've that's established under the statute or the proposed statute is so small that if you had one serious injury, say the first injury, say Marianne approves the a certificate, and the first injury you have is a very serious injury, and it's, you know, there's $75,000 worth of medical benefits and indemnity benefits that are due. If you don't have a proper amount of excess insurance, or if the excess insurance isn't low enough, you've exhausted your $43,000 or $62,000 worth of cash, and if the you know the five members in the group are really just five guys in pickup trucks and tools and some you know heavy equipment and a tractor trailer, then you're insolvent. You're insolvent immediately, and that is our concern. You know, is there enough money here to pay workers' compensation claims? There are some safeguards in that, in the security deposits, but you have to be insolvent to get to those. So we're wondering if the groups themselves are are not allowing themselves enough funding to take, so that they can guarantee a solvency. Marianne covered most of the things that I wanted to cover, and I don't want to keep going over it. Of course, the Guarantee Association, we agree with that. There should be some sort of a requirement for a Guarantee Association in case these entities do go a belly up. How are individuals going to be paid for compensation payments? Especially if there's over the short run, until we, you know, some of these things can be made, some of these assets can be made liquid, and money can be had from the securities, other deposits. The other thing I would like to submit to you is the group itself, and while I don't know what the proper number of members in the group should be, but I would submit that you would also want to put a minimum number of employees in that group. I know we require at least 100 employees for an individual employer, and you would probably want at least that, if not more. We look at this as a way of assuring that this entity is viable. It's a going concern. It has employees. It has it's a ongoing venture, and I would think you would want a similar sort of a requirement in this law. With that, I would most of the testimony I was going to say was just a repeat of Marianne's, and so I would just open it up for questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Grassi. Representative Codrey.
Yes, you didn't think the $1 million entry level maybe was adequate. What would you think the entry level would be in a situation like this?
You know, I don't know what that testimony was repeated a number of times. I'm not sure what that amount is, but it seems to me that at least we have an experience using $5 million. And we, you know, with a certain amount of success with that, which you know shows a viable concern. So, I would think that that's at least a start. I also would think that you would want some sort of requirement that some of those assets be liquid. You know, a percentage of those would be liquid.
So, Mr. Grassi, if there was five widget makers in the state with two employees each, they had net worth of $200,000 each, they could form a group under this?
That's the way I read it. Yeah. Yes.
Any further questions of Mr. Grassi? Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for the patience. And lastly, but certainly not leastly, that's not even good English. Strike that from the record. We've asked Ms. Robin Ward to come forward. Please identify yourself and your affiliation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Robin Ward, and I'm a member of the Alaska State Home Builders. I'd like to just make a couple of final points for everyone to consider. First of all, we want to make sure paramount that our workers are taken care of, and we feel confident. We've worked with the Division of Insurance and Workers' Compensation Division. We're willing to sit down and work out some of these concerns. We are not trying to say we're not willing to work at these concerns. We are. This is a long-term investment for us, and we are at risk for a long, long, long time. So we want to make sure that what we're doing is right. We don't want to make mistakes now. We want to make sure that what we come out with is something that we all can live with, including the Division of Insurance also. A couple of things to keep in mind. This is successfully working in 14 states. There's a reason. We use the model legislation from those 14 states. So I understand there's some concerns, but there is a pattern of success by using these where we have reduced the actual number of claims and returned some of that premium back to the very members and in turn lowered their operating costs to reach our final goal, which is affordable housing. That is our goal here. A couple of things that I wanted to just, again, make sure that everybody understood is to understand reinsurance, that they're exactly right. Reinsurance is we would pay the first section. What that section is how we negotiate with our reinsurance. If it's $10,000, so I guess what I'm saying is even if we start out with $45,000, you'd have to have four catastrophic injuries right away to deplete that, because if it's $10,000, they kick in after that $10,000. So I just wanted to make sure that you understand how reinsurance does work. We plan on putting it out to the agents. We will be another market for them to broker. Agents broker insurance. They get a commission for writing insurance, just like they would with any of the other commercial entities. And that, so they would use us as one of their markets. And so they could write us or they could write someone else. And rather than kicking people out of our group, we would rather put them on probation, bring in a team of peers, and help them work out their problems. We don't want to kick anybody out. Once we've invited them in, we want to keep them in there. And the records in other states show that 90% stay in and reinsure and are able to stay in because they're educated on job site safety. And we also have the ability that we do not today to have some hands-on management of our claims. We want to make sure that fraud is investigated. Someone who doesn't deserve work comp provisions shouldn't get them. We want to make sure that the workers get back faster if there's any possibility of doing that. So those are some of our goals. But again, I want to reiterate that we're more than willing to sit down and work out some of our concerns. This is, and legislation is meant to be, the framework, the guidelines. We fully expect to sit down and write regulations that cover some of these details. That's it.
Very good. Question?
No.
Well, I have some.
Okay.
Why wouldn't your association particularly consider the availability of the reciprocal agreements or reciprocal organization available under existing state law?
Because it does have the higher, we firmly believe, and if we need to look at making that $1 million of assets liquid, we will certainly look at that. We do not believe, and no one has shown us statistics that you need $5 million. That may be the requirement, but I'm not sure anybody's ever used that, and I would like to see something where they have. We feel $1 million based on other states is enough to have. That doesn't mean, remember, that's only the minimum. That doesn't mean that's what we're going to do. As we build up surplus reserves, we may cash that in, make it money that the group actually owns, and take those assets that are pledged, give them back to our members. We all don't want to live for the next 20 years with our assets pledged to this group. So most of the other states have put in more reserves and investment and keep it in there, and then give out benefits on the investment of that. But there are provisions that are much more restrictive in the reciprocals and the exchanges.
And would Do you think your organization would agree to, were we able to put together a statute like this, mm-hmm. would you believe to exclude the exemption from the premium tax in the state?
No, you know, actually, we would be very negotiable to the guarantee tax, the premium tax that puts aside a guarantee, because that would benefit us also. And I think that we'd certainly be negotiable to sit down and talk about that. Absolutely.
And I would also venture to say that, particularly your organization, but not all organizations that would qualify under the statute as written, would have substantially higher net worths and be a larger group of people rather than just five. Is that, that'd be a fair statement?
And please be aware that if you notice the legislation is drafted, almost everything is under the director's approval. That basically said, we know that this is going to go to regulations, and everything is under her purview.
Well, very good. Are there any further questions of Ms. Ward?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would have a request of Mrs. Burke. If you could provide the committee with the history on the rate reductions over a reasonable, say, 10-year period or whatever is convenient for you to show, and B, is with some examples, you might specifically look at the home builders type people just as out of curiosity to see what those the rate history has been. And then let's see, what else was there? Oh. And I know we're all busy with the Kassebaum Kennedy bill, but as thank you very much, Ms. Kirk. For the information of everybody in the room and the committee, the chair intends to hold this bill over, and I think the time would be well spent rather than to send this committee this bill to a subcommittee. Let's have the organizations that are involved with the bill right now work with the various departments and people that have voiced their objections today, and perhaps work with coming up with a better piece of legislation rather than formally housing it in a subcommittee here and bringing it back with the concurrence of the bill sponsor, and then we'll see where we go from there. I wouldn't expect that to be for some time. So the committee doesn't have a sense of urgency here right now. So. With that, this meeting of the Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
5:28.